We will proceed on to our 3 o'clock case. If the clerk would call the case, please.
The court will now call Roland Papa Garza, a.k.a. Juan Garcia, versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Jack C. Strickland will argue for the appellate. Mr. David L. Richard will argue for the state.
Mr. Strickland.
May it please the court, your honors. Good afternoon. I'm not sure I've ever been here in the afternoon before, so this must mean you're working extra hard. Let me start off
allegedly. Allegedly.
Allegedly. Well, okay. Now it looks pretty certain to me that you're working hard being here this afternoon. Let me start by, on behalf of the appellate, thanking you for the opportunity to argue his case before you today. This is pretty straightforward. We have a single point of error, as the court is aware, and it has to do with the warrantless search and the warrantless arrest of the appellant in this case. The Fort Worth police were the arresting agency, and they were called out to talk to a homeowner in the neighborhood here in Fort Worth about somebody making too much noise next door over the evening hours. They get out there the next morning, and they don't know the gentleman who's made the complaint. The complaint, just parenthetically, I will tell you, is a Class C misdemeanor, making too much noise in the neighborhood. It's not one that subjects somebody to arrest under normal circumstances, all things being equal. They talk to the gentleman whom they do not know. He describes the fellow that turns out to be the appellant. And the officers drive around the neighborhood and eventually discover him at a taco truck, I guess it's all the rage now, not too far from the house. They don't know anything about the credibility of the reporting citizen. They don't know him. They do not know the appellant. The appellant doesn't see them and flee or do anything to raise their suspicions, but they take him out of line when he's about to get his taco. And in very short order, they have arrested him. They've made an invasive search and discovered some methamphetamines, and they have questioned him on the body mic, and he's made an oral statement implicating himself without benefit of the proper predicate or without benefit of the warnings that the predicate under the Code of Criminal Procedure requires. So basically all of this happens in very short order, and all of these various steps sort of melt one into the other. As the court well knows, there's three exchanges or three conversations and meetings that officers can have with citizens. The first one is purely voluntary. Officer can stop and say, hey, you want to tell me what you saw or how you're doing or have you noticed somebody in the neighborhood? There's no, the person's not in custody. The person is free to leave. The person's free to talk or not talk to the officer as they see fit. And there's no search that attends a voluntary encounter such as that. That's clearly not what happened here. In part, we know it wasn't a voluntary encounter because the officers during the motion to suppress hearing conducted by our friend Ruben Gonzalez here in the 432nd said that he was in custody from the moment that they approached him, and if he tried to walk off, they would have arrested him for trying to evade arrest. So he wasn't going anyplace once the officers saw him. The second level of contact, as you know, is an in-custody situation, and that's where he is not free to leave, and neither are the officers free to search him. They can do a pat-down for officer safety, but they're not free to make any sort of invasive search. The person and may or may not be handcuffed, but they're clearly in custody. So the question is, was he just in custody, or was he actually under arrest, which is the third category and the most serious of the categories of encounters between citizens and officers. The officers say that it was merely in custody, but they notice that he's getting fidgety. And at some point during the following seconds, they actually reach into his pocket and they pull out some methamphetamine, of course, and the game is over.
Because he was reaching it, sticking his hand in his pocket?
He was sticking his hand in his pockets. It's unclear as to whether or not he was sticking his hand in the pocket where the dope was, or sticking his hand in other pockets there at the scene. They warned him a couple of times not to do that, and they said he was jittery and not paying attention, so they didn't. So I think at that point, it's clear that the officers, if they're going to use their best judgment, are certainly free to handcuff him and maintain this in custody sort of interrogation at that point. They were also free to conduct a pat-down, but they were not free at that point because he'd not been arrested, because they didn't have any probable cause to arrest him at that point. They were not free to conduct the invasive search.
Well, let me back you up a little bit.
Sure.
He matched the description of that the complainant gave, correct?
Particularly
he did. With regard to the blue arm sling.
Right. So the description was essentially a clothing description, which is not as good as a physical description of the individual himself. But you're right. That's why they.
But in
that's
this instance, the officers were they asked him out of line, got him out of line to investigate, and there is at least reasonable connection between the complaint that they are investigating and the individual who they are now going to talk to for purposes of the investigation.
I think,
because of the blue arm sling.
I think you're perfectly correct in
okay,
that.
Okay, so it wasn't a voluntary situation necessarily.
No.
So investigative detention, okay, they ask him out. Okay, so what is the progress of how things happened? It's my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that when he was fidgety, etc., but he was putting his hands in his pockets, then in response to that, he was asked specifically by the officers whether or not he had anything in his pockets that they should be worried about in terms of weapons. He kept doing it. They asked again, and then he responded, and the statement that's the problem here, which is, I've got some ice, okay, that's when it happened, before they patted him down.
Correct.
They didn't pat him down until he flat told them, I've got some ice. So even if he is saying, I've got ice, so you don't need to be worried that I have a knife or something, he was responding to reasonable questions from the officers with regard to, do you have something we need to be worried about?
I think that's true. I would put a finer point on the fact that they did not actually pat him down, but went immediately to the invasive search of his pocket. I would also contend that if they're going to ask him that incriminating question, particularly as was memorialized on the tape, that may lead them to the formation of probable cause, and then they. But then.
Okay. Now, what was the incriminating question, though? Is there something we need to be worried about in terms of our own safety?
Correct.
That's not problematic, whether it's voluntary or investigative, or arrest.
I think that it would have been and I would suggest to the court that it would have been a better response to him being jittery to number one, to handcuff him, to give him an oral warning as to his rights, and then inquire of him, now that he was no longer able to get into his pocket, as to whether or not he had anything incriminating or anything dangerous to the officers. I think the officers were just in too big of a hurry to do that, and I appreciate their you know, wanting to move along with the issue, but I think that would have been the safer course of action. Have I answered or evaded your question?
If you hadn't, I'd have kept at you. Okay.
Okay, fine. Thank you. The state clearly believed, by virtue of the fact that they introduced the oral statement, and in order to introduce the oral statement that was memorialized by the cam, the lapel cam, I guess, that they had, they tried to lay the predicate for the introduction of an oral statement, which of course is more restrictive than the introduction of a written statement. They just couldn't get around the fact that they didn't satisfy the predicate, because the oral exchange between the appellant and the officer did not include any sort of Miranda warnings to which he was entitled, and which the oral statement predicate requires. So they took him, clearly at that point he was under arrest, although our contention is that was an inadequate basis for the arrest, lacking probable cause at that time, number one. number two, and that was bolstered by the oral statement, which should not have been admissible because of the lack of predicate that was shown, and they made the invasive search of the individual. That led to his being taken down to the Tarrant County Jail, and of course, during the subsequent search of the book into the jail, they found some additional contraband on his person. So it all happened in a matter of seconds. Actually, it happened a lot quicker than it's taken me to try and describe it to the court. But that's the basis of it. Under most circumstances, this would have probably been pretty innocuous, but this man had a lengthy criminal history. He was indicted as being an habitual criminal. His range of punishment was therefore 25 to 99 years. Judge Gonzalez didn't overreach, but 30 years is still a pretty good punishment for this man to have suffered. And so it's our contention that the motion to suppress should have been granted by Judge Gonzalez, and I wouldn't be here taking up your Tuesday afternoon. Any further questions that you may have? I'm going to yield to David, who's a good friend and much more entertaining than I am, and probably is going to give you a lot better law than I've been able to give you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Richard?
Well, that's a lot of pressure. That's the first time I've ever been called more entertaining than Jack Strickland.
May it please the court. Well, the type of investigative stop here was a Terry stop based on reasonable suspicion. It was not, as you pointed out, Judge, it was not a voluntary consensual encounter. It was not an arrest for probable cause. It was an investigative detention based on this report from the homeowner that that the appellant and his next-door neighbor were making too much noise all night long that carried into the early morning hours. Now, at the time that Mr. Garza was stopped by the officers, and there were two officers, there was one officer, Dykert, who originally saw him a block away from the homeowner's residence, who reported the event and gave a physical description, including the blue sling. Officer Dykert then reported to Officer Buendia, who was in another vehicle, that he was in the neighborhood, and I think the Officer Dykert said he was responding to a burglary, an unrelated burglary call. So Officer Buendia was there first, and then followed by Officer Dykert, and then another officer that Officer Dykert was assisting. But those were the two officers that engaged in a discussion with the appellant. Now, I'm not going to tell you this isn't a close question, because one thing that Mr. Strickland didn't point it out, which is actually in his favor, was that this Officer Dykert, the first response Officer Dykert had when he was questioning the appellant was, do you have a pipe on you? Do you have a pipe to smoke crack, a pipe to smoke methamphetamine, something along those lines? And it was a kind of an ambiguous discussion between the officers and the defendant, because adding to the ambiguity about whether or not the officers were referencing a weapon was the ambiguous repeated comment by the appellant when he was asked, do you have anything on you? He said, well, I have what I do. And they said, what do you mean you have what you do? I have what I do. And then they said, do you mean methamphetamine? And he says, and you can listen to State's Exhibit Number 1. It's about 7 minutes long. He has a statement in there that says, I deal. And they said, you deal? And he says, no, that's not what I said. But clearly, that is what he said. He's very agitated. He He's mumbling the whole time, and it's hard to understand. I've listened and watched State's Exhibit 1 at least a half a dozen times, and it's hard to tell exactly what the defendant is saying and how the officers are interpreting that. But what Officer Buendia says is that when they first are approaching the appellant, they are investigating. It's an investigative stop. They pull him away from the taco stand so as not to, you know, interfere with the taco sales. They pull over. They're very polite to him. And they said, we need to talk to you about this incident at the house. He is very agitated and says, what house? What are you talking about? And they explain to him that they're going to go back and talk to the other person whose house he calls it his homeboy. He says, I was just at my homeboy's. And they say, and then it's very difficult to understand them, but they say, we're going to go talk to your friend, but right now we need to talk to you about making too much noise. And he says, no, something to the effect of that neighbor is always reporting things, lies, something to that effect. And then they say, keep, as you pointed out, Judge, keep your hands out of your pocket. And the judge, the trial court, made oral findings of fact and conclusions of law. And he says he reviewed the tape, and he noted repeatedly that he made gestures towards his pockets. Now, he's wearing very baggy clothes, and he's fidgety everywhere. So it's kind of unclear whether he's... It's windy, and he's wearing baggy clothes, so it's unclear where, you know, what he is going for. But after he says, I have what I do, and he makes this statement about dealing, the officers, because he's fidgeting and putting his hands in his pockets, they actually raise his hands above his head and do a pat-down search. And they say it's for safety reasons is what they do the pat-down search for. And, you know, clearly they don't find a gun or a weapon per se, but they find a very bulky, and it's unclear because it looks like the drugs come out of several of his pockets. There's Officer Dykart removes some of the drugs, and then once they get him with the handcuffs behind his back after the arrest for drugs, they find more drugs on him. And they're concerned about also his arm being in the sling, and he's complaining about the pain, and they're asking if he needs medical attention. But he's under arrest at that point. So, but I'm not going to tell you that there's not this initial reference by the Officer Dykart about do you have a pipe in your pocket? And that precedes the search. Now, before the argument, I gave Mr. Strickland a copy of one additional thing that I plan on, if I could, just maybe a letter brief to the court, pointing out how dangerous it is for police officers. Now, 1968 in Terry versus Ohio, I was in sixth grade at the time, and the Beatles were still together. Things have changed since then. And one of the things that have changed is that drugs, we now have, you know, fentanyl that can be mixed in powder form with almost every street drug that we have on the market today. And the CDC is what I'm going to send a letter brief on, has published a study talking about how dangerous it is for police officers who encounter powder containing potentially fentanyl on the street. Just a whiff of it. If somebody pulls fentanyl, it's like pulling a gun out of their pocket. Throwing the powder up in the air can kill a police officer. They're supposed to, they can't even field test the drug because it's so so dangerous. So I think that under the rationale of Terry versus Ohio, the nature of street drugs today, particularly fentanyl, means that officers have an additional reason not only to do a pat down on the outside for a gun or a knife, but if they're feeling a bulk particularly the fidgeting, and a defendant who says he actually has illegal narcotics in his pocket, I have what I do, that the officers are free to make a further search, and if they find a controlled substance in something like a baggie, which they did here, multiple baggies, they have the right to make an arrest at that point. And then following the arrest, they find additional drugs. This court probably tires of me and my briefs saying that that it's easy to lose the forest for the trees when talking about Fourth Amendment analysis. It's whether or not the officers are acting reasonably under the Fourth Amendment. All of the tests that are for Fourth Amendment analysis are really designed to get to that point. Is it reasonable for the officers to do what they did? I believe it is clear from the facts of this case that both Officer Buendia and Officer Dykert were acting reasonably when they conducted the search. Again, this was not a consensual encounter. It was not probable cause initially for the arrest. It developed into probable cause for the arrest. And the trial court, which made fairly detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law, believed that the search was reasonable, and we would simply ask that this court find that their officer's conduct was reasonable. If there aren't any questions, I'd simply ask, pray that the court affirm the conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. I think I have a few minutes. The first thing that I would ask the court to note is that we can all agree that street drugs and street crimes are much more dangerous now than they were in the past, and it's an evolving standard, I suspect, as to what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. However, there was no allegation that any of the things that David talked to you about, throwing your hands in your ear or jeopardizing the health or safety of the officers, took place in this particular case. And while it's interesting, it seems to me that that's really just a matter of conjecture or speculation, and really has no relevance to the issue before us.
Is there any case law that has dealt with the Miranda issue in the context of officers addressing an individual that they have detained who is exhibiting what appear to be the sequelae of drug-induced problems, okay? In other words, somebody's acting a little bit crazy or acting like they are, in fact, under the influence of drugs, okay? And they ask him, "What's wrong with you?" type of thing. Is there any case law that says if they ask that they've overstepped their bounds in terms of Miranda at that point in time?
I'm not aware that there is
because again, that could be a safety issue in terms of, okay, I'm dealing with somebody who may not be here with their full faculties. I could be dealing with somebody who's on PCP. That type of thing. So a question that is directed to the conduct that they are observing, even though it may not necessarily be criminal conduct, it implicates their safety possibly. Anything with regard to whether that's reasonable?
I'm not aware that there is any law on that particular issue. It would seem to me that sometimes we do lose sight of the fact that Miranda or warnings that are mandated for in custody, custodial interrogations, number one, and sometimes that's overlooked very, very quickly when we try and analyze these circumstances. And number two, I think the operative word is interrogation, and I think when we if we give interrogation the clear meaning that it's entitled to, we're talking about an interrogation for a crime, not an interrogation, quote, interrogation.
Was there any testimony from Officer Dykert as to what prompted him to ask the question about, are you in possession of a pipe?
Not that I'm aware of. No, Your Honor. No. So the second point I would bring up is that when David said that he acknowledged that this was a close question, I think, well, I just better keep my mouth shut and leave well enough alone if it's a close question. That's better than I usually have here. So that's all I have to say, and I yield my time, and good afternoon to the court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much for your argument. Your case is submitted.